All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Drew Allen is on the line with us, author extraordinaire. He's been a guest before in the past, and we're happy to bring him back. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, doing well. You know, as well as one can do in this America that is fraying before our very eyes.
America's last stand. Will you vote to save or destroy America in 2024? Let me repeat the title of that book one more time for people. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. America's Last Stand. Will you vote to save or destroy America in 2024? Let's talk about that very distinct, very direct, some might even say very aggressive title, Drew.
Absolutely. I mean, look, a lot's changed. You know, I was on here with you. It's been a couple of years, actually, Jason. But, I'm a father now, for one. So I've got a daughter who's 17 months old, and my wife's pregnant. We're expecting a second daughter in January. And, you know, it has changed me to some extent. The stakes are higher. You think about more than just yourself, right? You've got a family to take care of. And these policies the last 4 years have hurt me. I'm in a better situation than some people. Some people are in a better situation than me, but most Americans, the majority of Americans, are struggling and have struggled over the past 4 years. Whether it's, grocery prices are up close to 30% since November of 2020. Gas prices are up 15% just since January. These economic issues in particular are difficult, and it has another impact. It's not just that these economic problems are hard for the providers and the families. And my wife is a full-time mother right now. She was a private chef before, but she stays with our child right now, which is a wonderful, wonderful job. And she works harder than anybody being a mom. Here's the thing, as a father, Americans out there are having to pick up part-time jobs, seek other avenues to make revenue, right? Just to pay for the necessities that they have paid for in the past. It's not that our lives are becoming, more luxurious, that we're spending on all these things. It's just to keep up with what we were doing 4 years ago. I mean, that's what we have to do. How many Americans are making 30% more than they were 4 years ago? I mean, very, very few are doing that. And so spending more time to make more money to pay for the same things, it takes you away from your family, from your kids. And that's the real premium, right? That's the quality of life we talk about. Quality of life is how much leisure time we have, how much time we have to spend as we choose to, right? Not just to provide. And so I just intro with that because I'm not just some guy living in some ivory tower, that's unaffected by all this. I'm deeply affected by this, and I resent what's happening in this country, the illegal aliens that are murdering Americans. Anyway, all this stuff's going on, right, as a baseline. And so I understand the stakes of this 2024 election, and it really is an inflection point in American history. And what is so important for people to understand is that it is on par with 1776 and 1861, the American Revolution, the Civil War. Now, we're trying to vote our way out of this, of course, but that's how big the decision is, right, about what we're going to become in the future. And people have to understand those stakes. And that's one of the reasons, Mona, one of the most important reasons I wrote the book, to explain that to people and get them off their tuchuses, to save this country.
There's never one thing that you can point at that says this is the reason why. As much as we like to try to live in a soundbite world, we like to bullet point everything. Do you see something that's leading the path in terms of bringing us down the drain or bringing us to the situation where we're at? And after you give your XYZ, I'll give you my ABC and get your reaction.
Yeah, I actually think that the most significant threat is the open border. Economic policy, if we, elect the right people and push hard, we can change policies and so on and so forth to come back. It's not going to be easy, but these things are reversible. But the illegal immigration, I mean, we're talking about, up to 20 million individuals. And we've seen in Aurora, Colorado reports over the past couple of days that gangs of Venezuelans, illegal Venezuelans, have come across the border. They're in Aurora, Colorado, and they are armed and going into apartment complexes and taking them over and breaking into apartment buildings. I mean, this is one of those things that really tears at the fabric of a country. I mean, if you allow 20 million people who have nothing in common with America, who have no understanding of what it means to be an American, who are going to come here and feed off of the welfare state and expect freebies, who are also here because they are intended to become a permanent underclass that's going to negate any impact that these policies would have, right? Americans waking up and saying, hey, this is wrong. I'm not voting for you anymore. And so, you know, these politicians are going to take advantage of these 20 million. I mean, this is, you know, they try and give it a bad name, replacement theory, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's replacing American citizens. So in my opinion, it's the illegal immigration problem that is the most profound threat that we face, because it's consequential for generations.
So mine is along those lines, but for me, it's as simple as entitlement. I truly, I come from the Gen X generation, so I've literally been working full-time since I was 10 years old. At 10 years old, I was a 1099 employee. I was an independent contractor for the newspaper, and I worked there till I was 16. Then I started working three jobs, playing sports the whole time, being a part of all the student councils and key clubs and everything like that, to where we had to walk to school. We didn't get play dates. There was a lot of different things that come into it. I was a single father fighting cancer. You're a father now, so you have a whole new appreciation of what it's like to be a parent. For me, I look at the entitlement generation that has come about, whether it's illegal immigration or whether it's we are the first ones in line to get the COVID money or we're getting economic stimulus money first in line. There's a certain level of entitlement that has really changed America in my mind, at least the one that I grew up with. Again, I was born in 1974, so I'm part of that Gen X generation. We've never had a Gen X president. I don't know if that's by design or by accident or what the case is, but what's your opinion? What's your thoughts? What's your reaction to entitlement has really hurt America?
Well, you're getting to the core problem in the country. Look, we're a constitutional republic. And as George Washington said, as the founding fathers repeated, as other significant figures, enlightened figures in American history have also repeated, you know, it depends upon an enlightened citizenry. And, you know, these entitlements you're talking about, let me just say this. What makes America great, right? I mean, the United States of America is the crown jewel of civilization. In all of mankind's history, this is the greatest country that's ever existed. And it's because of our beliefs in, obviously, unalienable rights, right? Our rights come from our creator, not from the government. Our founding documents dictate a contract in which we, the people, are master and those in government are, in fact, servant. And we're seeing that flipped on its head. And you're seeing Americans who who no longer believe in exceptionalism, right? Exceptionalism is one of the hardest beliefs to attain, and few have actually attained it. And those that believed in exceptionalism came here to the United States, right? They immigrated here. And exceptionalism, of course, is a belief that you can, yes, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, but you can transcend the current circumstances, right? And what I noticed, because I was born in 1987, right? So I graduated 2009, kind of during the Great Recession from Pepperdine University. I moved to New York City. And this was hope and change, right? Barack Obama. And what I recognized was that hope had replaced exceptionalism. And hope is not a wonderful thing to believe in unless it's out of your control, right? If you hope that it doesn't rain today, that's okay because, you know, you can't control the weather. But hope otherwise gives up in this belief that you have the power to attain something. You know, it's like that play Waiting for Godot. You know, they just wait and wait and wait for someone to come and no one's ever going to come and save them. So hope is a terrible thing that is presented as something good, right? So Obama talks about hope. You know, he tries to get people and convince people to accept their circumstances, right? When he says, you know, just expect the economy to stay at, you know, 2% or whatever it was at the time, right? You know, you didn't build that, these types of ideas. So yes, these entitlements, you know, I lived in Italy for 2 years, working for Marc Jacobs, running a retail store there. And that's what I observed in Italy, a socialism, right? It robs human beings of this belief in themselves. And they look to the government to provide everything, and they effectively give up. So, yeah, I mean, there is a belief system fundamental to this country that makes us excel. And if you take that away, we become just like everyone else, and we become a nation in decline, which I think is what you're talking about.
Well, and hope really is very it's very open to interpretation. It's somebody I want to make sure I wasn't muted there for a second, but hope is a very it's open to interpretation. So somebody's hope is different than another person's hope. And that those are dangerous, slippery slopes, no matter what you're talking about, good, bad, or indifferent. And so I often tell people that we've really gone down this path of living in the planet of platitudes instead of the realm of reality. And one of the ways that I've seen hope be used is climate change. And I've been trying to educate individuals on climate change for over 20 years about how this is more about control. This is more about corralling the masses, more about really stifling what America has been built on more than anything. And I've taken my share of arrows and verbal daggers and everything along those lines. Where do you look at climate change in terms of when we're talking about your book, America's Last Stand, You Will Vote to Save or Destroy America in 2024, because climate change really seems to be at the top of the agenda.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because I actually do devote 3 whole chapters in this book to climate change and, you know, revealing it as the hoax that it is. I mean, you'll appreciate these because you've been fighting this fight for a long time. But, you know, the first chapter is the cult of climate change. You know, the second chapter on it's called The Climate Hoax Explained. And then in the third and final chapter, I address climate change and I say renewable energy kills. So, look, climate change, you know, it's Marxism veiled as trying to save the environment. And it is an existential threat to America and our way of life. It's not that climate change is an existential threat. That's not true. And in fact, many places would benefit from warmer weather. You could grow more food and so on and so forth. But the climate change agenda is an existential threat to our way of life. And all it is anti-capitalism. That's what it really is. And, you know, this idea, and it's so interesting because I've never seen somebody bat like 0 for 1,000 and still be looked at as some kind of credible source, right? These scientists that, you know, I mean, it's so funny. You can go back, of course, and look when they first started talking about climate change, you know, really seriously, maybe in the early 70s. And you can correct me if I get any of this wrong, but, you know, kind of the early 70s, they were warning of a apocalypse, a winter apocalypse, right? We're all going to die from, you know, in a frozen tundra, London and everyone else. And then, you know, you fast forward about a decade, none of those predictions came true. And then they said, oh, well, actually now things are warming. And, you know, there's no actual data to back up their faux science. I mean, they go back to the Industrial Revolution, right? And they look at, you know, a couple hundred years of history, less than that, really. It's like 182, 183 years in which we've been able to measure surface temperature data. And they use that 183 or so years as evidence that, you know, we are responsible for climate change. But these same scientists can go back and look at Antarctica, you know, 10,000 years ago or whatever. And it was there were crocodiles and palm trees, and it was like a vacation on a Mexico beach back then. So we've seen bigger shifts in the climate before man was even here. So, and they know this. And so for them to preposterously claim that, you know, mankind is responsible for all, you know, rising temperature, hurricanes, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's no credibility for it whatsoever, but they play off of emotion, right? And who doesn't want to save the planet? Who doesn't want to be a good steward of the earth? And so they play that up, and they bamboozle people pretty good, obviously.
Again, we're going back to the planet of platitudes versus the realm of reality. There's also feeling over fact, which is happening quite a bit. And we did go through the time when there was the propaganda of global cooling, global warming, and then climate change. Really, you get your cake and you get to eat it too. It really handles both sides of the thing. And when we're talking about the ushering in carbon and a number of different things, I call it the religion of environmentalism, because when you take away somebody's value system or push them to the extreme, you really can lead them around like a mouse with cheese. Because somebody really, if they don't have values, well, then they're just going to go with their wishy-washy or whatever the money is in front of them. Same thing with extremism. You can really control them much more. And that's where I see this going, because it is very easy to step outside and connect with the environment. Oh, look at, I'm walking outside and I'm connecting with the trees and I'm connecting with the flowers and the plants and I'm grounding myself. And when you look at the history of any sort of religion, and I'm talking about anthropologically speaking here, I'm not talking about political. I'm talking about if you go to a Pepperdine University or my alma mater, North Dakota State University, and sit in an anthropology class, the roots of religion are very much about atonement, very much about the Garden of Eden in Christianity. So I look at it very much how it mirrors a lot of religions and a lot of Christianity, especially, to where we must atone for our original sin through whatever global climate change and these types. So when you go do a Google search, you can see what your carbon footprint is on an airline. And they're introducing it with DoorDash, and they're introducing it with restaurants now, to where we're going to have all this carbon tracking that's going to accelerate our atonement for the planet. What's your thought on the comparison? You mentioned the cult, so I just had to bring in the religion part. Yeah.
No, I've never thought of it that way before. And I think it's brilliant. And I'm going to use that going forward to explain. And you're right. I mean, it is that way, but it's like the worst form of religion, because look, I'm a Christian. I have a wonderful church that I attend here in the Napa Valley where I live. It's not a woke church. It's biblical, Bible-based, and which is hard to find these days, by the way. But anyway, like the worst Christian, we all know them, whether you go to church or never went to church. But, you know, this reputation of this fake Christian, right, that shows up on Sunday and, you know, feigns, you know, some kind of deep belief. They're good people. But then they go out and they don't practice it. And that is everybody in the cult or religion of climate change, right? They're all virtue signaling, right? No one's really authentic. You have Barack Obama, who's got a home in Martha's Vineyard, just, you know, yards from the ocean that he says is in a few years gonna come up and destroy, you know, the earth. The same thing with Al Gore. The same thing with all of these advocates who fly around on their private jets, who emit more carbon emissions from their homes or cars or fleet of SUVs than any individual citizen does. And so I think it's a tremendous analogy. And of course, it exposes to me just the false faith, the false religion of climate change. But you're right. At its root, though, it's ingenious, because, you know, they're saying that CO2 is a pollutant. And of course, there's no difference in the CO2 that we emit than from our cars or from any of these other sources. It is CO2. And so really, they're saying that human beings are pollutants themselves, if you dig deeper. And if you can control, you know, CO2, and that's bad, you can control all of mankind's behavior and movements and what we do, right? Because we are and think about this attitude of these people, how sick it is, though. because they look at us as some unnatural presence on the earth. But we are a natural presence. We're supposed to be here. That's what's interesting to me, too.
We talk about the fall of America, and to me, that means the fall of capitalism, or more importantly, the free market. Mm-hmm. To me, you know, I'm a capitalist. I believe in ethical capitalism, which involves tithing and also giving back to your community, not about how much money you can make. No, it's about making money in the free market and then giving back to that community to help support the people who have made you into the person that you are, because you can go out and you can build a better mousetrap type of a thing. And it almost seems like we're going down this path to where the ushering in of this carbon, whether it's through carbon sequestration, which seems to be taking out a lot of energy, and energy does give us freedom. Electric cars. I mean, people can talk about it all day long that they're great, this and that, but we've seen that they actually have a negative footprint on the environment through the lithium mining, through the cobalt mining, through a number of different ways that they're being used. Talk to me about capitalism, free market, and energy. How do you see that? Is that involved in your book at all?
Yeah, it's all tied in there. I mean, I talk about how, I mean, in the pipe dream fantasy land of these cultists, even if you wanted to switch to all renewable sources, it couldn't possibly generate the amount of energy that we need. And most of it is harmful to the planet to begin with. You mentioned, you know, cobalt and lithium. I mean, we are stripping the earth. Water sources are being strained and drained in many of these places. Crops are being ruined. I mean, this is destroying people. Child labor, of course, is being used to mine for cobalt in so many cases, you know, young 10, 8-year-old African children. And, you know, you've got these windmills that are absolutely destroying wildlife, killing eagles, killing all sorts of birds, you know, sonar systems that you know, whales and other oceanic life forms utilize. Is being disrupted, and they're dying. They're crashing into things. They're washing up on beaches. So, none of this is effective. But you know, the free market, if there was a legitimate desire for it, if it was functional, if we had the technology for it, we would be using it. That's been my point all along too. As a capitalist, I don't seek to deprive anybody of their electric vehicle, but there isn't a market for electric vehicles. I mean, I talk about in my book about when I went off to Pepperdine University and we made the drive from Dallas, Texas, where I lived, out to Malibu, California, right out, you know, near Los Angeles. And it was a 2-day drive. Both days we had a drive all day, pretty much. The halfway mark was Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I explain how many days it would have taken, like 8 days to get there in one of these electric vehicles. And my family was not ultra wealthy. We wouldn't have been driving even in, you know, a Tesla that had the longest mileage, you know, per charge. And it's just impractical. And so, you know, these are kind of playthings for a lot of people, these electric vehicles. I see them in Napa Valley where I live everywhere. And they're just, they, it's so funny. You know, they drive their Tesla, and then in the garage, they've got their Porsche, they've got their Ferrari, they've got their big old Cadillac SUV, but they want to virtue signal it. But again, I don't care if you want to have an electric vehicle, that's fine. But you're seeing these companies right now, and it's devastating them financially. They are backing off of these electric vehicles and pushing them. But of course, this is fascism, by the way, too. When the Biden administration and Democrats in particular right now who want to mandate this, right? In California, where I live, Newsom wants to mandate the forced transition to electric vehicles by 2035. I mean, the dates change from time to time, but it's so impossible. And, you know, the other thing is there's not enough electricity. People act like these electric vehicles, like, I don't know, they charge off of oxygen. We have, you know, rolling blackouts and brownouts out here. And I think it was last year, there was a heat wave that came through California. And, you know, from Sacramento, the capital, Newsom and the media were putting out, hey, You know, if you've got an electric vehicle, make sure you don't charge it and you don't go anywhere. Stay confined to your home because we don't have enough electricity to power your vehicle today. I mean, there is no utopia in store for people that are going to switch over to this electric vehicle thing. I mean, it really relies upon abject ignorance to push people to try and embrace it.
You mentioned some of the renewables in California. You know, California in the 90s, they had a mandate to try to get, I think, 10% or something like that of electric vehicles. And they only got like 1% or something like that. And the hybrid market was the one that took off. And it did really well. And then California kind of put the kibosh on that and doubled down to say, no, we want electric vehicles. And then the hybrid market has kind of gone away. And to me, that was a real signal because the free market did allow the hybrid to organically grow. And there's a lot of people who really did like the hybrid because electric vehicles, I have never met anybody who's got, at least where I'm up in the Midwest, who's kept it. They all bring them back as soon as they can because the cold takes care of them. A hill takes care of them. If you want to tow your boat to the lake, you can't do it. A friend of mine that I'm thinking about specifically, his wife wanted one, so he went and got one of these Audi electrics. And they had to schedule their weekend around the charging because there was only a couple charging stations. And because of the amount of energy needed, you can't just plug it in your house. I mean, you can only have a certain amount of charges per neighborhood because the grid only allows it. And so there's a lot of issues. And so we're really putting the horse before the cart on this, but you're out in California now. Does anybody ever talk about that as far as the hybrids? They were taken off in California and it was working. It was the state that stepped in and said, no, we want electric.
Yeah. Well, I kind of vaguely remember those days. I was an actor at the time in Los Angeles and I had a handful of friends that were buying those Priuses, right? I mean, the Prius was kind of the quintessential hybrid out there that everyone was looking to buy. And I thought, okay, I mean, I didn't want one personally, but I thought, okay, this is nice. I mean, you save a little bit on gas here when it switches over and so on and so forth. But I wasn't particularly studied on what happened to that market. I didn't realize why it just kind of evaporated. I guess, yes, it's this push towards all electric. And, you know, the thing too is, I mean, in order to force, I mean, there's no going back once they do it though. That's the problem. And you know, everyone's going to have buyer's remorse. It's like they're having to do the same thing with solar panels, right? I mean, that they did with solar panels. It's the same kind of model. I mean, solar panels, again, they didn't even think back, you know, 20 years ago when California was making the big push to incentivize people to put solar panels on because they were subsidizing them, right? So it wasn't actually cheaper. It was actually enormously expensive, but, you know, they subsidized it to get these things going. And now they've kind of, you know, the lifespan of a solar panel is 20, 25 years. And now all of them need to be replaced. And they don't know what to do with them because they're harmful to the environment. They have all types of deadly, you know, lead and so on and so forth in them. Which ironically, you know, they banned, you know, lead bullets, for example, but there's lead in the solar panels. That's not a problem. And so now they don't know what to do with all these solar panels that have to be discarded. And this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, even politics aside, even my belief and knowledge, I mean, it's a fact that this is a hoax perpetrated, like we've talked about, to attack capitalism and seize our liberty. But even that aside, just be pragmatic. I mean, it doesn't work. It's not going to work. We're not there yet. Like you said, you know, the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse. You know, I mean, it's just ludicrous. And I just can't believe that these cultists don't even ask any of these questions because it affects their lives profoundly.
So when I was in my 20s, when somebody would defend the Constitution, I would roll my eyes at them. I wouldn't make fun of them. I wouldn't call them crazy. I wouldn't anything like that, because if anybody has passion, I'm going to listen to them and I'm going to give them the time of day and that sort of thing. But I would kind of roll my eyes at them because I never really understood the Constitution. It was just something that I read about in history class, and history was boring to me. But I'll be 50 this year. And the older I get, let's say the last 10 to 12 years, I have developed such a respect an understanding for the Constitution, because it does take out discrimination. It eliminates so many problems that if people just followed and understood the beauty behind what the Constitution brought to civilization, it's really hard for the average person to grasp. And I'm saying that because I had a hard time understanding it when I was younger, because, hey, I was making good money, life was great, all these different things. But it was probably right around when my son was born, I guess, you know, that sort of thing, when I started just changing a little bit, having different values. But when you really look at what the Constitution represents, it does. It takes out discrimination, because everybody has freedom of speech. Everybody has a right to bear arms. Everybody has the right to not allow seizures and searches and those types of things. Talk to me about where you're at with the appreciation, or do you still roll your eyes at the Constitution?
No, I've always had a deep reverence for it. I've always been a big history buff. And, you know, I mean, this is something I get into in the book as well, but, you know, we're so fortunate to live in the United States of America. Most of us didn't have to do anything to secure these sacred blessings of liberty and prosperity. You know, that's kind of how Abraham Lincoln talked about these benefits that we have. And so, you know, we were kind of fat and happy and lazy. But, you know, I'll say it again. I mean, the United States of America is the crown jewel of civilization. And our Constitution is responsible for that belief in exceptionalism that we're talking about before. The rejection of kind of entitlements, you know, these are the beliefs, these are the foundations that are responsible for us exceeding the rest of the world and enjoying this place at the top of the mountain, looking down on all these other countries that cannot possibly compete with us, our liberty, our prosperity, our security, all of it. And right. I mean, equality is baked into the Constitution. And, you know, the Democrats, you know, left-leaning people, socialism, fascism, communism, all these things, you know, want to replace it with equity. They want to replace equal opportunity with equal outcomes. And so they demand more government intervention in everything. And you know, with healthcare, with everything else. But here's one of the things I wanted to get into, because you mentioned something earlier that kind of made me think about this. What's interesting is you see the left in particular that believes that government is absolutely benevolent, right? In their opinion and mine, there is no higher calling than being a Democrat politician. And, you know, at the DNC, I watched, you know, Oprah Winfrey and Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, and the Obamas are worth, you know, $70 million. Oprah Winfrey's a billionaire. And I saw them stand there and talk about, condemn people like me on the right, so-called right, that want to tell people that government is corrupt. And they talk about how all these private citizens and companies and wealthy people have taken more than they need. And I look at these people, you're being lectured by Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, and Oprah Winfrey. These people are wealthy beyond imagination. And yet they're not willing to give up anything they have. They're very happy to go and work for the government, in the Obama's case, or the Biden's, or many politicians. And they don't go to sacrifice like the founding fathers intended, right? I mean, in the past, the idea was that you made something of yourself in the private sector, you learned about the world, and then you went and you gave back by working as a politician. If you look at Congress, you know, those salaries are roughly $180,000 a year, call it $200,000 a year. And the people that are now politicians in Washington, D.C., they're making more money than they're ever equipped, ever qualified to make in the private sector. You think that, you know, Eric Swalwell, or pick your politician, favorite politician, you know, AOC, you think that they have the credentials to earn $200,000 in the private? They don't. And so we're being ruled by a bunch of ideologues who don't have any experience, who are radicals, and we're being ruled by our inferiors. And, you know, I read the speech that Calvin Coolidge gave, President Coolidge gave in 1926. It was the 150th anniversary of the, you know, signing the Declaration of Independence. And there's so many truths, like if you're reading the Bible, that just they're so evident and they don't change. And one of the things he said, even back then in 1926, is to beware of people out there who would try and improve upon the principles of the Constitution. You can't improve upon the ideas of equality. You can't improve upon the idea that our rights come from our creator and not government. And yet you have people in this country that are, you know, presenting something as progressive when really they are trying to replace the most progressive ideas and civilization in mankind's history with something that is regressive, that's been tried and failed before.
This book that you wrote, Drew Allen is our guest, America's Last Stand, Will You Vote to Save or Destroy America 2024? Drew, it almost sounds like a voter's guide.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, it's not boring. It gives you information that's relevant just as an American citizen. But, you know, we have a decision to make in November that is going to change the course of our lives and our history. And people need to understand the stakes and they need to understand what they're up against. I mean, we're up against a media and a party that has been consumed by tyrants. And you've got to understand and distinguish between what's real and what's propaganda. And you've got to have a foundation and understanding of our history and what's happened before us. So, yeah, I mean, this was intended to get, I mean, there are plenty of people out there that are on the fence that are trying to decide what to do. And I wrote this book for them to help explain it and understand it because, people need to get caught up with information and knowledge. And this book is intended to arm them with facts and the truth.
You brought up the media. I had that down in my list of questions to ask. Where's the media in this? We have a different world. You know, when we look at the progression of media, I've been in it since I was 10 years old. I started as a newspaper carrier, so I fell in love with the newspaper, which was the news. I became a writer, got published at age 16, started in radio when I was 18, became a publisher of my own magazine at age 22. So I've been in the media very much since I was 10 years old. And when I take a look at when the internet came, that was a paradigm shift. And the reason I say it's a paradigm shift is because within a few years, about every newspaper in America went bankrupt. And when you consider that 95% of the newspapers in America had a monopoly for 50 to 100 years in any town they were in, except for maybe New York, Chicago, some of the big markets had two newspapers. But if you go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, there was one newspaper. You go to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, there was one newspaper. So a monopoly went bankrupt within 3 to 5 years after the internet came out. That was a legitimate paradigm shift. And the government gave the money to Google, gave the money to Facebook, gave the money to Yahoo, gave the money to Twitter. And they actually really became part of the story that destroyed the newspaper. And the internet essentially really became a reaction to the news. So you still had the Associated Press and you still had some newspapers creating the news. But Jon Stewart from The Daily Show, he used to always say, we don't give you any news. We're a reaction to the news. We don't educate people on what the news is. They come in to watch our show and then they like our reaction, but we don't actually create any news. And I really look at that as something that has been either by design or by a fluke, but it happened either way, to where we have changed so much of what the news is. We use words like fake news, traditional news. Talk to me about the media, because it's changed so much. People don't trust CNN anymore. People have a hard time trusting anything on Facebook. Where can anybody get the news? How can people trust anything out there? Talk to me about how the media has played a role in all this.
Well, you know, something interesting happens when you put somebody on a camera under lights and make their voice sound great. It kind of elevates their importance. You convince yourself that, you know, maybe they're smarter than you or better equipped than you or something like that. That's not true. You know, I think this just comes back to warnings from the beginning of our country, Abraham Lincoln, tyranny. You know, the media has become as corrupt as the Democrats would claim that corporations and so on and so forth are. And the idea that corrupt individuals who have ulterior motives and want to control other people's lives, that they would be in the private sector but not seek opportunities and roles in government is insane to me. And the same is true in the media. And so you've seen this, you know, not to get into hyperbole, but whether it's Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or communist China, the media always tends to have an alliance with tyrants. It's necessary to secure their power. So, you know, you can't really legislate morality, I guess, is what I'm saying, too. And it has to come from somewhere else. And we've done a poor job of that as a country. We've let our morality get away from us. And so you have plenty of people in the media now who are criminal in the way they conduct their jobs. They do not, like you said, report the news, and they do not trust the American people to make an informed decision for themselves. They want to tell you what to think. And they believe themselves part of a hierarchy in this country in which they, as media members, members of the press, are above you, right? Like in socialism or communism or fascism, there is no equality. There is a belief that there are some amongst us who are too stupid to fend for themselves, and therefore people must be elevated to positions to run those individuals' lives for them. And to set the outcomes and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the media in this country is a disgrace, and it's one of the greatest threats to our freedom. Right up there, maybe when you asked me at the beginning of the show my opinion on that, and I said illegal immigration, well, the media is up there as well, because they seek to make perception reality. And it's a powerful thing. And they do not view their role, of course, as informing the American people. They view it as replacing reality and controlling, and it's effective, as we've seen.
Anything that we left out that you want to highlight in the book that you want people to make sure that they know about your book, America's Last Stand, Will You Vote to Save or Destroy America in 2024? Drew Allen is our guest. You can get his book at Barnes & Noble online or Amazon. And what's the takeaway? What's kind of the big highlight points that you want people to walk away from?
Well, I think that this should be the easiest election in any American's lifetime. I mean, remember when Ronald Reagan, during that one and only debate with Jimmy Carter, he looked into the camera and he said, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" And the answer was obviously no. And he defeated Jimmy Carter in a landslide. I think this is a very unique election. We have lived under Trump, and we've lived under Biden, and Harris is no different. In fact, she's more dangerous. And so if Americans have any sense of self-preservation, they have families out there, should be the easiest choice ever. Life was better under Trump. My life was better. Everyone's life was better. And we are staring into the abyss. And so, I mean, in the book, I explain what is in store for you if Trump is not elected, and in fact, we get Kamala Harris and Tim Walz instead. And, you know, at its heart, it's a very pragmatic book. And I'm a pragmatic person. You know, I arrive at these conclusions because I deeply love the country, and I have responsibilities and a family, and I deeply care about my responsibility as a citizen, as a father, as a husband. And so I actually just urge people to consider the arguments in this book before they cast their vote, because you're not going to get this one back.
It's a little concerning that President Trump was almost assassinated, and it only made the news cycle for about a week. And nobody talks about it anymore. You hear nothing on the assassination attempt, the young man who tried with his connections with the FBI going back and forth there. That's scary. That is a scary time we're in, when politics aside, you know, there was a assassination attempt at a president. And like I said, it only made the news cycle for like a week, and that was it. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it just shows how sick and perverse our media is, how detached they are from reality and morality. They still want to talk about January 6th, you know, and they don't want to talk at all about an assassination attempt. I mean, you know, it's a rhetorical question, but do you think the media would still be covering an assassination attempt on Joe Biden? You know, I mean, you have Tim Walz, who's absolutely guilty of stolen valor. You have Donald Trump, who was invited to Arlington Cemetery by Gold Star families whose sons and daughters were murdered in the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was carried out by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And the media is spending their time attacking Trump for taking pictures with the Gold Star families, accusing him of violating some kind of, you know, law at Arlington Cemetery that you can't use it for publicity and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, Kamala Harris lied about working at McDonald's. She never worked at McDonald's. She said she did. You got Tim Walz, stolen valor. And you have an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. They're just so irresponsible, Jason. I mean, you know, their rhetoric is directly responsible for that action that took place. I've got a whole section of this book devoted to what I call 21st century Jim Crow. And that is how right-leaning people, people that aren't Democrats, people that think for themselves, MAGA, you know, there is a caste system in place that has been here for a while in which, you know, right-leaning people are targeted, whether it's official or unofficial rules in our society. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who was the press secretary at one time for Donald Trump when he was president back in 2017, she went to dine at the Red Hen in, I think, Lexington, Virginia. And when the owner of the restaurant recognized who she was, she kicked her out of the restaurant because she was worked for the Trump campaign. Rand Paul was had his ribs broken on his own lawn by a neighbor, Rene Boucher. You know, you had an assassination attempt on Trump. You had the congressional Republican baseball team. You know, Steve Scalise almost lost his life, right? A shooter opened fire on them. He went over and asked briefly before, are these all Republicans? He was told by DeSantis and another guy that were talking at the time, yeah, they're Republicans. And he went and shot it up. And then it was determined that he was a big fan of Bernie Sanders and was incited by the same rhetoric. So, I mean, it's just everything's one way and it's disgusting. And I want peace. I want prosperity again. I want my daughter to play sports against women, not biological men. I want teachers and the Democrat Party and the teachers' unions to stay the hell away from my children and not try to indoctrinate them to cut off their, you know, PPs when they're 12 or whatever else and then try and hide it from them. I mean, we're living in a insane, just like backwards, amoral world. And I care too much about my family and children to sit here and watch Kamala Harris and the Democrats continue to perpetrate this, like, really despicable. It's communism and Marxism on this country. I mean, I can't comprehend, Jason, that at this point anybody can support them. And of course they want to make this election about like who's a nicer or better person, right? Kamala Harris doesn't even tell us about her policy. She does like a 15-minute taped interview. You know, and meanwhile, Donald Trump's out there being an open book, going every podcast, talking to the American people. And I just, so much of what they've said about Trump isn't true. And that's one thing that's in the book, too. It's setting the record straight on who he is and what he's done and what the other side has done. But the media has covered up and lied about it. I mean, it's just you've got to acknowledge reality right now. And it's a scary time to be a father. I got to tell you, Jason.
Drew Allen is our guest. He's an actor. He's also an author. America's Last Stand is the name of his book. Subtitle, Will You Vote to Save or Destroy America in 2024? You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. And I did want to ask you one final question, because this one really bothers me. And I you seem like you're mature enough to handle this without going into the politics of it, so to speak, because one thing about labels are designed to divide us. Okay, that's the one thing that's been around since the dawn of man. But there's another thing too, is people, when they want to control, they will tear you down. And you mentioned the transgender issue that's going on right now.
Yep.
And to me, I look at this completely different than everyone else. I look at this as if the government, who I believe is trying to remove religion, to try to remove the value system in people or push them to an extreme so they're easier to control. So if you can actually remove facts from people, as simple as what is a man and a woman, boy, you can really control them with anything. That's how I look at this whole transgender issue, is it's another way for them to tear us down so they can build us back in their likeness. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's exactly true. It's another avenue. I mean, you hear them, and this is what communists say, you know, we need to reimagine America. And of course, that requires erasing what America's actual history is, tearing down monuments and lying about our history, saying that we're, you know, inherently racist and so on and so forth. And yes, when you eliminate, I mean, think about it. You can't define what a woman is. I mean, you can't have a conversation with people anymore, right? You can't even make arguments if people are operating from these places in which it's basically languages, different languages, right? I mean, they tear away all of the definitions of things. I mean, when it came to the COVID-19 vaccine, it's not a vaccine in any traditional sense, because everyone has acknowledged it doesn't prevent the contraction or spread of COVID-19. You can still get it. And so what did they do? They went and changed the definition of a vaccine so that they could still call that shot a vaccine. The transgenderism issue, I mean, to confuse children, to tear down their sense of identity and who they are, it's one of the most evil things you can do. And of course, the reason you do that to children is so that you can make them, you know, obedient to the state. And what's amazing too is this like LGBTQ flag and stuff that you fly at high schools and middle schools and elementary schools now. I mean, they don't want the Ten Commandments and separation of church and state. That's a whole nother, you know, 2-hour conversation. It doesn't exist. It's not real. It's not true. It's not there is no separation of church and state. They didn't want us to be a theocracy. There's a difference. But nonetheless, they don't want the Ten Commandments in classrooms. But they want to put, you know, LGBTQ plus and gender theory and critical race. These are religions unto themselves. So, you know, you have to pick and choose what you believe. And they want you to believe in the state's omnipotence, right?
Drew, we got to have you back more than two years, man. It's good to talk to you. It's refreshing. And how can people, I mean, what's the pitch to get people to buy the book?
Well, it's just, I mean, I think it's the most important, relevant book out there right now. I mean, it's the only one that really deals with the present circumstance in a very serious and direct way. And I think there are people out there, you know, a buddy told me the other day, he's got a friend who runs a business, he's a Democrat, and he voted for Joe Biden in 2020, voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, but he cannot vote for Kamala Harris. So I don't know what he's going to do, but my point is there are people out there that are on the fence. And some people are uncomfortable having these conversations. I mean, this book is for them. I mean, it gives you, it's like, you know, Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, and the most important thing it did was it forced people to talk about the stakes, right? People were reading them in bars and pubs aloud. And so that's why I wrote this book too, is to create a conversation, right? To put people like, okay, what is a woman? You know, you can't converse with people. Well, you know, two people that read this book have a foundation of understanding. So, I mean, I just think it's that important. You know, not because I wrote it or anything like that. I just, you know, that was where my heart was. That's why I did it. But yeah, and people can find me on drewallen.substack.com. You know, I've got a Substack going, you know.
Oh, great. All right. We'll make sure we have the links available. Check the bio, folks. Check below for all the links. Drew Allen, America's Last Stand. Will you vote to save or destroy America 2024? Go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and buy it, folks.